Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the reviews continue to pour in. Postmortem from the left on Tuesday night's elections. And it seems to be holding. Just as the election results held for Republicans, the postmortem seems to be holding for the new Marxists that dominate the Democrat Socialist Party. This was Julian Castro, the Bond villain who tried to run for president. You remember him.
And he has a twin, too, an identical twin. So Joaquin, there's two of them out there.
So Julian on election night had this to say.
We need to rethink in 2021, going into 2022 and beyond, what we think of as an electable candidate. There has been a lot of oxygen spent blaming the progressives, suggesting that perhaps our best bet is always a centrist candidate. I think we need to rethink that. And these midterms traditionally have been elections where you need to get the base out. You need to get them excited.
And you understand that Julian Castro and others are referring to Terry McAuliffe as a centrist candidate.
Really?
That's the indictment of Terry McAuliffe. He lost because
he's not progressive enough.
He didn't embrace the left. This is AOC's quick take yesterday.
Plus, on the election front, I actually think we have good news as well. I know that Virginia was a huge bummer. And honestly, if anything, I think that the results show the limits of trying to run a fully 100% super moderated campaign that does not excite, speak to, or energize a progressive base. And frankly, we weren't even really invited to contribute on that race.
Super moderated campaign. That's what Terry McAuliffe ran, saying parents stay out of the education bureaucracy's way when it comes to your kids, among other positions he's taken. He was on board for the full complement of leftist policies. He brought in their leftist president.
And the vice president.
Yep. And the former president.
That's right, Obama was there.
But just so you know what they think Terry McAuliffe, super moderate, and this is good news. And I say this because it means that they'll continue their path forward. They'll continue this path going forward, I should say, because it's not a path forward. It's a path to enslavement. But they'll continue on this path that they're charting for themselves going forward. And that also includes on the socialist tax and spendathon. So if you thought that maybe, well, there'd be some nervous Nellies and they'll come Manchin's way and then maybe say, well, maybe Joe Manchin is right and let's just get a deal done, something that is less grandiose than we had envisioned, but something nonetheless. It seems like they're hunkered down to say, no, the problem was not only that we didn't get what we wanted done, but that we have Joe Manchin as we're trying to negotiate with Joe Manchin, really. When we shouldn't be negotiating with Joe Manchin, we should come back over the top of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, put the stuff back in that we
took out,
you know, as a way to try to work out a deal, including, by the way, the Biden White House. No. Let's get all that stuff back in and let's double down on what we were doing.
Yeah, family leave is back now.
And that was the topic of conversation yesterday. Pelosi puts paid family leave back into this tax and socialist tax and spendathon. And I think originally it was 12 weeks of paid leave. Now right. I think they're down to 4 weeks of paid leave.
Yeah, and then it was gone. Now it's back to 4 weeks. But yeah, originally it was 12 weeks for paid leave.
But either way, it's a deal breaker for Manchin, and that's good news if you want to borrowing a phrase from Steve Moore, kill this bill, which I want to do. Here was Joe Manchin trying. I mean, again, just before we get to Manchin, he is a big government hack, okay? He's a big government hack. However, that is useful right now against these Marxist ideologues, these doctrinaire government takeover artists like you just heard from Castro and AOC and the entire caucus is really Pramila Jayapal, who you hear from in a second. So this is Manchin trying to deal with socialist cheerleader Mika on Morning Joe yesterday.
People are having a hard time driving to work and paying $20 or $30 more to fill up. They're going to the grocery stores and getting 30% less. They're about ready to face a very bad winter, we're told, at much higher prices. So yes, I think we should be upfront, honest, and transparent with American people and do what we can afford to do.
Mm-hmm. All right. And that includes being honest about the accounting for what the socialists want to spend.
So you've just described the realities surrounding exactly why these bills need to get through. What is it? I've got a checklist here. I'll write it down. What is it going to take to get to yes?
Well, to get to yes is first to find out what the real cost is, what we're talking about. We're using 10 years of revenue to basically supply 1 or 2 or 5 or 6 years of services. And that's not the true cost. The true cost would be 10 years to 10 years. So if you have 10 years of revenue, then you would think that if we put a program in place, that program would last 10 years too. This all needs to come forward, and we need to have a CBO score. The Congressional Budget Office truly puts a score to this. But Mika, the only thing I would say is the rush to this, and I've said this long before, I truly believe that we need to slow down. I truly believe that we need to wait and see if inflation is transitory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is Joe Manchin admitting what we know to be true, but it's nice to hear it from Manchin that the way they're trying to reduce the price tag on this, which is, by the way, the $1.75 trillion is also a lie. It's more like $4 trillion. But the way they're trying to do that is to say, here's what we're going to generate in revenue, and here's what we're going to spend. So all the we're going to say this is a 10-year program. We're going to spend all the money in years 1 and 2, or, you know, depending on the proposal, 3, 4, and 5. And the point is, launch the program, and then no one will have the temerity to end the program, so it will continue to get funded in perpetuity. You just got to get it off the dock.
I believe in family leave. I believe people should have that opportunity. But I've seen states that have already done it in America. I've seen countries around the world that have already done it. Can't we find a better position for this and do this in a bipartisan and in a process that works? Because here's what we're talking. We're talking about unpaid family leave now. That's going to add an awful lot to the debt that we already have at $29 trillion. They talk about Medicare expansion. I would love to be able to expand Medicare if we had our financial house in order, but when you have a report from the CBO that you're going to be basically insolvent in Medicare by 2026, and you want me to add more on to it to make it insolvent quicker, I've got people in West Virginia, Mika, that's their lifeline. Their lifeline is Social Security and Medicare, and I'm doing everything I can in my power to protect it and get those on solid financial grounds so people can depend on it. Then we can expand. Because when you start the programs, you never stop them. You just don't. And we're trying to get something that's sustainable.
And President Biden said yesterday, oh no, 2 days ago, he said, once this bill gets passed, inflation's going to go down. It's going to get better, folks. Really? I don't believe him.
Of course,
it's
just open-ended promises. It doesn't matter if they confound Econ 101. Joe Manchin, once you start these programs, they just go on.
Forever.
That's just how it is. Exactly. That's the play here. And it's not that Joe Manchin isn't on board for that play. He just wants to go, again, at a slightly slower pace than 98% of his party. So, you know, don't tie too much of your future to Joe Manchin's leadership. But in this moment, he, you know, does seem to have his finger in the dike, so to speak. That back and forth between Mika drew this response from this Pramil Jayapal, who's the manager for the Socialist Spice Girls and the rest of that Socialist Caucus. She came on Morning Joe right after him and had this to say about what you just heard from Joe Manchin on paid family leave.
Okay, but you know that he won't accept that.
Yes, and that was, look, that was the speaker's decision because I think really because millions of women across the country are outraged that one man would say we're not going to do paid leave.
One man.
That's how you get treated. You may be technically in the same camp, but if you're not going along with the folks that are interested in reimagining our economy, as AOC's former chief of staff famously said, transforming America. If you're not down for the transformation and at their pace, then you're just a man standing in the way of a bunch of outraged women.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
And of course, Joe Manchin has a cult following now, literally. He's got a bunch of people following him around to the parking garage.
Putting their bodies in front of his Maserati.
The Mother Gaia, the Mother Gaia Brigade's here.
We want to live.
They've got a big side mansion is burning our future for profit in the background, chasing him into this parking garage. And, boy, that was an opportune time for Manchin as these unhinged children were throwing a temper tantrum as he's walking to his car. Opportune time for him to use the old Reagan line of, if you're our future, then I'm selling my bonds. That would have been so great. He missed that opportunity.
Would have gone viral.
Sean in Crown Point, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, sir.
Morning.
I just wanted to ask one question. If those Republicans that won in these elections, they wasn't cheated, right?
No.
I don't know. No evidence of that, no. Was Phil Murphy cheated?
It was a fair election then, right?
Yeah, Phil Murphy wasn't cheated either then, right.
I'm just saying, you know, everybody's questioning elections now.
Not even the opposition is questioning.
Camp
isn't questioning the results of the election.
Yeah, not everybody's questioning elections. We're questioning specific elections with specific questions. That's not everybody's questioning every election. Sorry, Sean, that's not right. And by the way, speaking of that, Sean, since you brought it up, you know how a democracy is at stake if we don't federalize elections? You know how we can't trust the states to administer elections, Sean from Crown Point? Because that's what your buddies like Pagliacci Schumer and the rest of the socialists on the Hill are saying, isn't it? It is. Isn't that why you've had that federalizing of the elections legislation already run through the House? Yes, it is. Isn't that what Biden and Reparation H are saying? Yes, it is. And so what happened in Virginia? Because, you know, people can't vote. Republicans are trying to prevent people from voting, Sean, from Crown Point, right? 3.3 million people turned out to vote in the Virginia governor's race compared to 2.6 million 4 years ago in the same race.
Wow.
So it's so hard to vote. It's so hard to vote. And by the way, two-thirds of voters polled in New Jersey support voter ID. So it's so hard to vote if you have things like voter ID and other, you know, modest measures to protect election integrity. So difficult. It's just impossible. You're disenfranchising people, right, in two blue states, Virginia and New Jersey. And in Virginia, you saw almost a 30% increase in turnout. In the New Jersey governor's race, turnout was 2.5 million, more than 300,000 more votes than last time.
Good.
So the canard is not on legitimate questions about specific elections. The canard is the need to federalize elections based on people can't vote otherwise because the people are being disenfranchised if you advance these modest measures that were advanced in places like Texas and Georgia and Florida and elsewhere. That's the lie, Sean. But nice try.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and we'll get to the vax mandate on businesses. But since we place so much promise in this, and we followed this for so long, and were openly critical when the Durham investigation wasn't completed before the election, wasn't completed on the timeline that Attorney General Barr suggested it would be. It's important to follow up as this investigation is now producing results, and it produced another one yesterday with the indictment of the key source of information used to compile the Trump dossier. Igor Danchenko, associate of former British intel officer Christopher Steele, released on a $100,000 bond after a brief court appearance where he pleaded not guilty. He pleaded not guilty to lying to the FBI. The statements that he made allegedly falsely stating to FBI agents on June 15, 2017, he had never spoken with a Dem PR executive about the dossier allegations. On March 16th of 2017, falsely stating to the FBI he received a late July 2016 call from an individual who Danchenko believed was probably another operative, when in truth, in fact, as the defendant well knew, he was never called by that person. And other statements he made to the FBI that were false as it pertains to his role in this conspiracy, conspiracy to manufacture a narrative against President Trump and have that narrative picked up by federal law enforcement to create this cloud and years of investigation and calls for impeachment.
Right. I mean, the document was used by the FBI to illegally spy on Trump, but this guy, Danchenko, he was the primary researcher of the dossier.
Yeah, remember.
So people got to remember that. And if you don't know it, then know it now.
He was Christopher Steele's primary subsource. Yep. This Christopher Steele, who we just heard from.
On 60 Minutes.
Stephanopoulos. We have institutional knowledge here. We have memory here in a way that the D.C. press corps doesn't. And I'm sure you won't hear this. Now, with his indictment, now consider what Christopher Steele had to say to Clinton Foundation Donor Zero when he came forward just a few weeks ago.
I think there are several reasons. I think the first and most important is that the problems we identified back in 2016 haven't gone away and arguably have actually got worse. And I thought it was important to come and set the record straight.
Well, he's the hero in the story.
All right, of course.
He's the truth, justice, and the American way guy, even though he's Brit. Some of the statements he made in that interview were so telling.
Well, I mean,
like this.
I'm prepared to accept that not everything in the dossier is 100% accurate. I have yet to be convinced that that is one of them.
The music behind it.
Yeah, the grand concession, I believe, I'm open-minded to the possibility
that
everything wasn't accurate, was not accurate. And again, at the time, 3 weeks ago, he stands by the dossier. Even after he just conceded, he's prepared to accept that some of it's inaccurate.
Yeah, and they asked him, too, about the alleged, you know, golden shower tape and does it exist? And he's like, could. It might.
Well, that's the whole thing. He's not willing to concede is non-factual.
It was all lies.
Especially the compromise was word of mouth and hearsay, conversations with friends over beers. It was just talk.
If you have a confidential source and that confidential source is blown or is uncovered, that confidential source will often take fright and try and downplay and underestimate what they've said and done. And I think that's probably what happened here.
He's afraid?
I think anybody that's named in this context, particularly if they're Russian, has every reason to be afraid.
So you stand by the dossier?
I stand by the work we did, the sources that we had, and the professionalism which we applied to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now he stands by it with his subsource also under indictment for lying to the FBI. The question becomes, too, you know, after enough of these individuals get done being indicted for lying to the FBI, Clinton lawyer, not to mention the FBI attorney who was indicted and pled guilty to doctoring an email, when does the FBI get folded into this conspiracy? When does it become beyond the pale of credulity to believe that Comey, you know, sophisticated attorney like Jim Comey and Andy McCabe, senior level FBI, didn't know that they were being lied to. When does this script flip, I'm wondering? And those people that lied to the FBI, when does it become clear that Comey and McCabe and Strzok knew they were lying?
Right. They were in on it to take down Trump.
Had every reason to believe they were lying. And so can you be indicted for lying to the FBI when you are the FBI?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
That seems to me the big question is, we know Andy McCabe lied, and he lied under oath before Congress, and yet all that generated was a professional rebuke from the inspector general.
Right.
When do we get beyond professional rebukes and errors and omissions and mistakes were made and protocols were violated and so forth to these individuals who the FBI, starting with Comey, placed so much confidence in, enough confidence to pull Trump aside and brief him about the existence of this dossier, enough confidence to let this play out over years, consuming the public's attention for no particularly good reason, consuming mind share for no particularly good reason, other than their own political aspirations and their own political agenda of trying to derail Trump. But that's not supposed to be the FBI's job. If the Democrats want to conjure up a conspiracy theory, they're welcome to do that. It's the FBI and the intel agencies lending credibility to this, even when they were silent. Their silence lends credibility to it as well. Why aren't they denying it? Why doesn't the FBI come out and say there's nothing to this? There's no reason to believe any of these Russian collusion stories. No, they were not only silent, but they were active participants when they were doing things like surveilling Carter Page.
Well, that's right. Where can he go to get his reputation back? I mean, he was destroyed. He lost his home. He lost everything.
So, you know, as frustrating as the Durham investigation was in, you know, the lack of any discernible progress, any deliverables before the 2020 election, and it's still frustrating, but at least there is some work product coming to light now. And as we talked about when Hillary Clinton's attorney Sussman was indicted, you know, you start to see a picture coming into focus. And so I know there are going to be skeptics about any accountability for senior leadership at FBI, and maybe we don't get there. It's probably more likely than not that we don't get there. We don't get to the level of McCabe and Comey. McCabe, who has had his pension restored. Strzok, who's got a sinecure at Georgetown University.
Oh, nice.
I mean, it's so insulting. But on the other hand, I'll tell you what, the way this is shaping up leads me to be a little bit more optimistic than I was even after the Sussman indictment. A little bit more optimistic that this is methodical and painstaking, but there is a desire to go wherever the facts lead, no matter how high they go. And so I'm a bit encouraged by Durham's workmanlike efforts here, even as critical as I was at how long they were taking last year, I got to say. Marvin in Burlington, Wisconsin.
Yeah, what I find fascinating about this is that these guys are supposed to be the professionals and are able to decide or figure out who's lying and who isn't. And they were taken in by this hoax. I mean, mm-hmm. How good are they at their job? And if that's how good they are at their job, why are they at their senior level at the FBI? Maybe this is why we're having intelligence failures left and right. Maybe this is why we've got guys like Aldridge Ames and that they can't find for 20 years. You know, I mean, if this is our best and brightest, we're in big trouble.
I mean, look at what they did with the Larry Nassar investigation and how, you know, they changed reports for some of the gymnasts who were victimized by him.
Yeah.
No, they testified on the Hill. Who trusts the FBI anymore? I mean,
the anthrax case, Richard Jewell.
That's right.
Larry Nassar, the Russian collusion. I mean, over the last 20 or 25 years, there have been some very high-profile, catastrophic performances by the FBI. And I think that the question is legitimate to ask, which we've asked former FBIers who've come on the show to discuss this case and other cases related to the FBI. You know, I mean, should this agency even exist in its current form anymore? No. This wasn't created at the founding of our country. There's nothing written in the Constitution that this Federal Bureau of Investigation shall exist and shall exist in perpetuity. It's just another federal agency. Do they really provide so much law enforcement value over the top of state and local law enforcement? Or should it be taken down and reconsidered? You want to have a Federal Bureau of Investigations or something like that? Well, fine, but start over, because it is indelibly corrupt and politicized, which is sort of a synonym in Washington, D.C. terminology. I think that's a fair discussion to have. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, I would love to be hopeful like you are that Durham's on the right path there and everything, but these are like these little crumbs and everything mean nothing to me. Carter and Page and everything like that. But here, they're not getting anywhere near Comey and Brennan and who's the other one? McCabe, Brennan, and McComey. I mean, they're too high at the top. They're like protected and everything like that. So if they got it to Durham, like where they got him scared and he's not going to go after anything, the fact that
I don't think that's the case. I don't think that's the case. He's not. Durham doesn't strike me as scared. He's not going after anybody. That's not what's happening here.
I hope you're right.
Well, I mean, thanks for the call. I know they're still low level, but I mean, this is essentially a crime family case. You work up the pyramid, and yeah. It seems to me that's what Durham's doing. Now we'll see.
I mean, this is fast. In this 39-page indictment, I didn't read the whole thing, but I mean, Danchenko lied to Steele about where he was getting information, and some of the information came from the Democratic Party operatives,
right,
that had ties to Hillary Clinton. So they just made stuff up, and he reported it to Steele. Then Steele produced this dossier and handed it over to the FBI and ruined Carter Page's life and almost took down President Trump.
And you know, don't,
because
and,
why they didn't
Comey,
want Trump
McCabe,
in office.
Strzok and Page, right? Yeah, those four in particular.
But they should all be in jail.
So you have this Russian guy acting essentially as a cutout between the Hillary Clinton campaign and the guy they've retained to compile the dossier. Mm-hmm. So it's all fictional. If we got this guy, this Russian guy, and we'll make him a source for Steele, we'll be on both sides of that deal. So it looks like Steele has a Russian source that's close to these things. He feeds what we feed to him, to Steele. Right. And now it comes full circle. You know, that's the food chain right there. Then it comes full circle back to us.
Another Hollywood script. Here we go.
Jason in Northlake.
Yeah, it's not a matter of the FBI being lied to. It's literally the FBI getting the things that they want to try to go after Trump in the first place. Because the FBI has just gone, even back to the days of Hoover, the FBI has never been a righteous organization. It has always been the political tool of whatever ruling class has been able to put their higher-ups in there to control what's going on. So defund the FBI.
Thanks for the call, Jason. Amish Texter calling on the Tin Can and String Hotline.
Yeah, thank you for taking my Dixie Cup and String call. Well, you guys know what the FBI stands for, right? The forever Bidening it, or forever Brandoning it.
Forever Brandon what?
Forever Brandoning it. FBI.
Forever Brandoning it. Forever Brandoning yes. it. Brandoning oh. is now a verb.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
Very good. All right. Thanks for the call, Amish. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I don't know if you've had the opportunity yet to read all 490 pages of the OSHA Emergency Temporary Standard as it pertains to the implementation of Biden's announced vaccine mandate.
Aren't we going to read it at a Freedom Summit tomorrow?
It's a doozy, yeah. We'll do a little fireside chat.
Yeah, there you go.
Again, January 4th, all employees in companies with more than 100 employees must be in process of being vaccinated. However, a month earlier, December 5th, all unvaccinated workers must start wearing masks indoors. OSHA will be conducting on-site workplace compliance inspections, they say, with penalties for violating the rules ranging from more than $13,000 up to more than $136,000. So what are you going to do as an employer who's folded in under this, or as an employee who's working for an employer who is falls under this mandate? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro
text line. Such an overreach of government yet again, and it's weaponizing OSHA. I have a very close family member who works at Advocate Lutheran General. Listen to this. Hi, Amy and Dan. OSHA has nothing better to do than visit large hospitals and businesses to make sure everyone's wearing masks properly. Here, they're taking pictures of non-compliant employees, which we've been told we can refuse to have them do that. And everyone in that hospital is vaccinated, but they're walking around like tough guys, like they're the cops. People that they've known before are now feeling empowered to snap pictures of employees while they're working if their mask slips below their nose. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Hospitals do not, there's no provision for hospitals to have a testing alternative to being vaccinated. That is for employers with more than 100 employees subject to the vax mandate. You can do a once-a-week test of employees who are unvaccinated and make them wear masks. That is not available for health care institutions, for hospitals. Okay. Interestingly, by the way, the testing once a week, if you're in with an employer that falls under this mandate, you pay for that.
That's another
problem. The employer
does
not have to.
And it can't be one that you go buy from Walgreens or CVS. It's got to be a PCR test, one of the more expensive ones.
According to Kaiser Family Foundation survey last week, 37% of unvaccinated workers say they would leave if their employer required them to get a vaccine or be tested weekly. Mm. A quarter of all adults said they knew someone who has left a job because of a vaccine mandate. Well, it's about to get more interesting. Tom Bevin over at Real Clear Politics made a good observation, too. There's no exemption here for the trucking industry specifically, even though they work basically solitary jobs and they're not in a lot of contact with people. So if you thought the supply chain issue was a problem now, this is certainly not going to make it any better in the near term.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. I mean, we're fighting to keep people on their job, on the job as it is. And one trucking company owner was on NBC Nightly News last night, and he said, "I don't know what I'm going to do. I have no choice. I mean, I just..."
Well, he does. There are some options, and we're going to go back and listen to some comments we had from an interview we did with an attorney and a former corporate exec with Whirlpool and GE. We went through this in advance of what we anticipated coming down the line a couple weeks ago, so we'll refresh people's recollections about how this is going to play out in the courts, because, of course, this is going to be litigated. You've got 26 states that are filing suit against this. Let's go to a unidentified Metra employee on the South Side. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, how you doing? Basically, the mandate was handed down a couple days ago. There is no possibility for testing. That's just not going to happen. They basically are going to tell us by the 21st of January whether we're going to have a job or not. Their Metra is at 26% ridership compared to 2019. And let's put it this way, it's a hot topic in my family right now, whether I'm going to keep the job or get the vaccine. And I've been looking. So now it's at my age, we're somewhere in 50 years old. I'm now having to start all over again. And, I think it's an overreach. I think it's ridiculous. And it's got to be unlawful somewhere, somehow. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for the call.
Thanks for sharing your story. Gosh. But where is he going to go?
To a
company that has less than 100 people?
Maybe. 26 employees? I mean, excuse me. 26%. I'm thinking employees. 26% ridership at Metra.
Wow.
As compared to 2019.
Why even run the choo-choo?
How do public transit? I mean, again, once the funny money subsides, how do these public transit systems in big metropolitan areas even survive?
Well, they got to get people back to the office, and they're not going to do that. Those days are over. We've changed our culture. Well, that's not going to happen. So the choo-choo train is going to go bye-bye.
Well, not necessarily. The choo-choo train just becomes a money pit for all of the patronage hires that are there. But the question is, how long can you sustain that without any revenue or a fraction of the revenue coming in that at least offsets some of the subsidization that was required? It's very interesting, but that's a topic for another day. Vince in St. Charles.
Good morning, guys. Okay, I work for a major grocery chain, and it's not Mariano's. I drive. It's very quiet. If I have to, they haven't said nothing yet. I'm asking around. No one knows nothing. If they force us, many guys will leave. I will leave. But if they pay for testing, it's okay. But we're already short drivers, and I could tell they're getting worried because they're changing things around. And if they have to go with OSHA, then that's going to be another problem because OSHA doesn't help us when we need them. So if they think they're going to force us to get a shot through OSHA, that's another problem.
But how much do you interact with other people? I mean, if you're a truck driver, aren't you by yourself in your cab most of the time?
Well, I am in my cab, but I have to go into the store
and
do what I have to do. So I interact with a lot of people, all sorts of vendors and everything.
And you've been doing that. And you've been doing that this entire time without incident.
Absolutely, no problem. So there's a couple guys that have got the COVID, but have come back. A couple guys get the shot, but there's a lot of guys that want nothing to do with the shot.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like 2 years away from retirement. Oh. So I'll go. I'll leave. It's easy. My family already knows that I'm going to sell and I'm going to go to a free state. So that's where we're at. It's quiet.
But it doesn't matter. This is the federal government. This overrides state rules. That's what I read.
Well,
unless someone wants to correct me if I'm wrong, but there is no free place.
Well, it's a federal mandate.
It's a federal mandate. So you can live in Florida.
Then,
it doesn't matter.
I'll go. Well, Florida's fighting back.
Yeah, they'll file a lawsuit.
I'll go to less than 100 employees. I mean, or I'll figure something out. But if we're not going to get we're not going to get the shot. Like I said, it's quiet. We'll wait to see what happens. It's quiet.
Well, let us know what happens too, because if they pay for your testing too, but they should do it while you're at work and not make you go on your time, your day off.
I think they will do that, but it's quiet. Okay, thanks.
Thanks for the call, Vince. Appreciate it. Steve and Roselle.
Yeah, I'm wondering, maybe this will all go away when Joe Biden figures out jobs is a four-letter word.
All right. Thanks for the call, Steve. John and Elgin.
Yeah, all these mandates. So yesterday I went into the post office, and there's tons of signs requiring me to wear a mask, yet none of the post office employees wore masks. So
don't tell OSHA
that.
They'll come and take a picture of them.
Thanks for the call.
Find their own government, $14,000.
Yeah, I don't think the post office is their target. Post office is, a law unto itself. Also this, too. So these mandates become, these are life mandates, right? Is that what it's going to be? I think that's a question to be asked. A study by, a study that was published in The Lancet just the other day, Kaiser Permanente and Pfizer studied the real-world medical records from 3.4 million people in California. They found 6.6% of double-jab people who caught coronavirus between December and August.
Okay.
That's about 12,000 people out of 184,000 ended up in the hospital.
Ooh.
It's not inconsequential.
No.
But the study also found this. This is interesting. Found that the jabs prevented 88% of cases for a month after the second dose, but only 47% after 6 months. So now we're getting down to, when we'll get to phase booster, as other countries like the UK are already there, and we're getting there now. But so 47% protection, if you will, after 6 months. So then with the disposition of the COVIDians, how do they not mandate boosters within certain windows? And then how are they going to manage that? Everybody is going to have their records kept in terms of when they got the second jab. And then 6 months and a day after the second jab, that's the time you have to get your booster within so many days or you're fired. Or if you don't get the booster, then you go back to being tested and masked. How is that going to work?
I have no idea. They don't even know either. Well, they expect people to, you know, keep up with their own medical decisions and, you know.
No, they don't. No, they don't expect people to keep up with their own medical decisions. The entirety of this is about keeping track of people. So I want to understand, and people should be asking, how are you – ask your employer, how are you going to keep track of this? When they do this, then what's next? We're just going to take this posture to wait to see what happens and then wait to see what's imposed.
Well, the whole, you know, and real quick, you know how the political press scene – I'm sorry, I can't think very well today. You know how they came out and said, you know, if you're not vaccinated and you play sports, you're going to be tested once a week? That never happened. In any fall sport at the place where I worked, it's just a suggestion and a threat.
Well, yeah, but
to get people vaccinated,
you have to understand it's like contact tracing, which is like you know going on unevenly. You know, from the beginning, it's nonsensical, and it was, you know, arbitrarily utilized in some places and not others. That's the whole point. The whole point is that it's unknowable. And when it's unknowable, then it's just the whims of the people in charge. Rob, the gas man in McHenry.
Hi, guys. I was just calling.
Is that your Christian name, Rob? Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. No. Industry, so, you know, driving these trucks around all day, it's like, you know, if they're going to try to force the mandate on the drivers, it's going to be quite interesting if they try to force it on the fuel haulers, because we're in an industry in Chicago which is basically run by a bunch of unions, and we're one of the only companies out here that we're not, none of these companies are union, and a lot of the drivers are leaving already because they're not making enough money and they are being forced to work 70 hours a week, and none of them want to take the vaccine to begin with. So I don't know how they're going to survive when all the gas stations are running out of fuel. And you can't get diesel into these terminals where these trucks need to haul goods to these services to these companies that are going to sell them to the consumer.
That's a good point, Rob. Thanks for the call. Yeah. These are the sorts of things that the central planners don't consider when you do one size fits all. Michael and Edgewater.
Yes. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. Love your show.
Thank you.
So if they're going to be fining companies for not mandating the vaccination, these companies are going to take a major hit. Shouldn't they be trying to save money, maybe by firing employees who have been vaccinated to save money? If you can be fired for not getting it, you should be able to be fired for getting it. That way, save money.
Yeah, okay. I'm not advocating anybody be fired or based on their vaccination status, but I like the jujitsu there. Dan in Downers Grove.
Morning, Dan and Amy. I have a company, 24 employees. I'll just shut the company down. I'm not going to take it, and I'm not going to force my employees to do it. Second point is that OSHA has to be invited on your property. They cannot just walk in and just start walking around and talking to people. They must be invited in, and you can refuse to let them in.
I like that.
And the last question is, is what's next? Why don't they just tattoo my forearm with a number so they know who I am?
Mm. Thanks for the call, Dan. Well, I'm
and he's got 24 employees, so he doesn't have to worry. It's 100.
Doesn't have to
more.
Worry yet.
Yet, right?
Yeah, yet. I mean, again, if this is good enough for, I mean, how is 100 employees? It's just arbitrary. Why not 99? Why not 101? Why not 25? Why not 250? It's just arbitrary. If this is an emergency, then how do you draw the line at 100 employees?
Well, and why are we waiting until January 4th? It should be done now. I mean, this affects 80 million Americans.
So here's the thing. We talked to this attorney, Joel Weber, a few weeks ago about this. And there's at least two lines of litigation, and they're being pursued. So pay attention and watch how this plays out. One is the Administrative Procedure Act, and that requires a period of comment before a regulation, an administrative regulation, is promulgated and has essentially the force of law. Because, again, this is not passed by Congress. This is not a law. This is an administrative rule promulgated by an administrative agency, and this was purposely done to get around having to go through Congress. So there's that piece of it, and then there's the religious infringement piece of it. Joe Weber spoke to both of them. You'll see litigation that raises both of these issues, both, and the religious infringement, it's both a constitutional issue as well as a statutory issue under Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So that said, here's what Joel Weber suggested companies, employers do.
I would hold my powder in the sense of watching the various circuit appellate courts in the country, which is where this kind of action will be challenged under the Administrative Procedure Act. Watch those courts. If you're in Chicago, watch the Seventh Circuit, et cetera, and see if the courts impose an injunction against enforcement of the regulation. That's the mechanical, that's the procedural step. And if you get that if the injunction is there, then you do not have to implement.
Right. You don't implement until that is resolved by the courts. And I tell you what, I think that the injunctions around the country are likely. And I think the case against this OSHA-imposed mandate, you know, by way of the Oval Office, I think this is going to fail at the Supreme Court level, which is exactly where Joel Weber thinks this is going to go, because you're going to have different appellate courts make different holdings with respect to this. But it all turns on whether or not this is an emergency situation that triggers extraordinary governmental powers to react to this emergency. And this was his comment about that.
I happen to agree with you that it's not an emergency, because it is sufficient to over. Basically, I waited 9 months to issue this rule, and now I'm going to tell you it's an emergency, right, and I don't have time for the public to be heard from. But the courts ultimately will, the Biden administration through the Justice Department will make that case, and ultimately their Solicitor General will make that case to the U.S. Supreme Court, because I expect the various circuit courts of appeal will have their own varying takes on this, and it won't be resolved until it gets to the U.S. Supreme Court. But Amy.
And he was agreeing with that point that you made when we talked to him about an emergency situation that took nine months to.
Right.
Yeah. So, the bottom line in this is, yeah, stay tuned. Stay tuned.
Well, so 19 states have filed lawsuits against the Biden administration for vaccine mandates. And do you think those same states are going to file a lawsuit against
this?
There's
more. There's more piling on the OSHA mandate. They were waiting for the language in the OSHA mandate to come down. It's come down, and now you're going to see litigation throughout most of the country.
Good.
Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, the great Chicago reporter, humorist, Finley Peter Dunn, observed famously now that the job of the journalist is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. But it seems to me now, at least the D.C. press corps and its urban outposts in places like Chicago, the job is to comfort the comfortable and afflict the afflicted. That seems to me what's going on in journalism. But the question is why? Well, for an interesting take on it, we're pleased to be joined by Batya Ungar Sargon, who's a deputy opinion editor at Newsweek, and she's got a new book, Bad News: How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. We talked about her piece that was posted at Barry Weiss's Substack a little bit the other day, but now we have the source. Batya, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning to all of your listeners. Thank you so, so much for having me.
Oh, our pleasure. So what has happened to journalism? You really point to essentially a social strata, a class, and by extension, wealth. And that has significantly changed within the journalism profession over the last several generations, so that now journalists start out as part of the ruling class, if you will.
That's exactly right. You know, we look at our media and we often talk about it like the problem with it is that it's politically polarized, or the problem with it is that we talk about race a lot. One side does, one side doesn't. And of course, those things are factors, but the source of the difference between conservative and liberal media today is not really race or politics, it's class. That's the argument I make in my book, that the reason that you might feel that contempt coming off of journalists increasingly is because they actually are part of the elites, and they actually do look down on everyday Americans and working class Americans because of a status revolution that journalists underwent throughout the 20th century. So it used to be, Dan, that a journalist was a working class job. It was a blue collar trade. You know, in 1937, for example, they did a survey of the elite journalists who work in Washington, and less than half of them had a college degree. In fact, a lot of them hadn't even graduated high school. And if you fast forward to today, 2015, they did a study. You'll not believe how many journalists have a college degree. It's 92%. And with that status revolution, as we know, the economy is working really, really well for people in the knowledge industry. Over the last 20 years, journalists have become increasingly affluent. And now even to become a journalist, you have to actually really come from money, because the way that you get that job is to go to a really elite college, as opposed to learning it on the job the way they once did. And so I argue that all this has contributed to the way that journalists really look at the rest of their fellow Americans, which is very much from a kind of almost ivory tower of journalism, as opposed to living amongst them and describing America, the America that you and I know.
Well, I worked in newsrooms for 21 years, and I have to tell you what I noticed toward the end is that there's a lot of journalists, and especially a lot of meteorologists, who were acting majors who couldn't make it in acting, but they still wanted to be on TV, and they were good looking enough, so then they joined journalism. Did you discuss that at all in your book? I know it might be an ancillary issue, but it's a thing, I swear to God.
I did not discuss that, but that's hilarious, Amy. Oh, my gosh. I didn't even think about that. I was focused more on people who, you know, there is a sort of, I think there's a sense among journalists that was described by a lot of conservative intellectuals like 30 years ago, that their liberal counterparts, you know, felt that they deserved more power and more money than they were getting. They didn't understand why, you know, politicians and corporate lawyers were making more than them. And I think that there is a lot of resentment among journalists today, but it's really, you know, the funnel to becoming a journalist is really narrowed with the collapse of local newspapers. So it used to be, you know, you would, like I said, you'd pick up the job on the job. Your editor would probably be someone who hadn't gone to college. His boss would probably be a Republican, right? That's kind of how the local news industry operated. And so even though journalists have always been slightly more liberal than the rest of Americans, there was, you know, a countervailing force, right, pulling in the other direction towards a more moderate point of view. And today, because of digital journalism, right, you know, digital journalism rewards high emotion. It rewards extreme engagement. And so the journalists now are increasingly far left on issues of identity because they've all been elite educated at Ivy League colleges. And the business end is pushing them to indulge in these sort of woke opinions because it's good for business, unfortunately.
Yeah, and so I just wanted to, there's a couple of points there I wanted to develop a little bit more. You know, going from the days of the copy boy at the Daily Planet who works his way up, mm-hmm. I mean, those days are gone. And part of the power they sought came with the advent of the cable news networks and 24-hour televised news. And then all these journalists, whether they're technically reporters or they're columnists, it's hard to distinguish between the two anymore. They become part of these roundtable discussions. So then they get their own celebrity and they get their own book deals and they get their own contributor salaries on these networks. And so it becomes this cottage industry of a very small group of people who all basically have about the same intellect, which is not a compliment, and went to most of the same schools and studied, you know, at some of the weaker disciplines at those schools, whether it be education or journalism. The social science is not anything, you know, you don't have a lot of mechanical engineers running around as journalists, for example.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, we're having this whole conversation about critical race theory in schools, right? And something you'll notice is journalists going, well, that's not critical race theory. There's no critical race theory in K-12, right? And that phrase, there's no critical race theory in K-12, they are using they're highly educated, very specialized language, and their familiarity with this academic concept to browbeat parents and be like, essentially be like, you don't know what critical race theory is. I know what critical race theory is.
Right.
You don't get to criticize the schools. You don't know enough. I know enough. You know what I mean? It's so gross.
Well, gross. Yeah, it is. And the other thing, the business model you mentioned. See, I think some people say, oh, you know, the advent of Trump brought about this opportunity to go hard left as a counterbalance to Trump. And this is why the CNN saw its viewership spike and the New York Times saw its subscriber spike. Now, what actually has been happening, I think you sort of memorialized this, is over time with these individuals controlling so many other elite institutions and now the Fourth Estate too, is you have essentially a bunch of people who think like you, who've had the same lived experience, two-thirds of the country that goes to colleges and particularly the smaller subset that goes to elite colleges, that becomes your subscriber base. And so now all you're doing, because you've created this environment, you've created this community around this content, you're just feeding this subscriber base so the business model works, and then it radiates out from this insular circle of very alike people intellectually and in terms of ideology, and it sort of radiates out like a cancer and starts to infect the rest of the countryside, and it metastasizes, and that's sort of what I, you know, how I inartfully describe it.
That's exactly right. You know, the question I sought to answer with my book was, I know that these ideas about identity, you know, about intersectionality, ideas like open borders, the mission creep of what counts as racist, right? I know that these are niche ideas that were cooked up in the Ivy League. How is it that suddenly not just the New York Times, not just the Washington Post, but the Atlantic and Vox and every single outlet is now catering to people who believe this? Where does the market come from when I know that the vast majority of Americans think that this is malarkey? Why is it that all of the liberal publications and outlets are now obsessing over it? And by the way, it's not just me who's saying they're obsessed with these issues of identity that are sort of academic. Sociologists have tracked it, and you're absolutely right, Dan. It started long before the Trump administration. What they did was they trawled the archives of the New York Times and the Washington Post and NPR, and they found that around 2012, there began to be an absolute skyrocketing of uses of words like racism, slavery, Islamophobia, transphobia, you know, this total revolution, just an absolute obsession that has become today a moral panic about racism. Of course, you know, there are areas where racism still exists. I know you agree with me about that. Areas that we absolutely need to talk about, areas that we absolutely need to be focused on. But this is not that. This is not saying, look, you know, there's a problem with this. There's a problem with education. There's a problem with policing. This is an outright obsession. You know, the use of words just over and over and over. And it created a feedback loop with a highly educated, affluent liberal subset, which is the target audience of all of these publications, where their views shifted to where they now see racism more than black people. They now see white liberals now see it more than Latino people. And it's, so it's the feedback loop with the media, where the media was catering to this highly affluent set, and this highly affluent set then sort of gave this feedback loop where they gave them their business in exchange for reading about white supremacy every day, right? That's the feedback loop that I describe, and I try to analyze why that happened in the book.
Do you analyze, too, how the media was so obsessed with President Trump? I mean, Don Lemon, remember, he hosted a panel discussion with white women who voted for Donald Trump for no apparent reason. There was no need for that.
I talk about how the media treated Donald Trump a lot, because the funny thing about Donald Trump is that his economic agenda was compiled of things that Bernie Sanders had been talking about in 2015. So think about it, right? Bernie Sanders in 2015 was talking about the need for border control to protect working class jobs. Bernie Sanders was talking about getting rid of NAFTA, which President Trump did. Bernie Sanders was talking about a trade war with China and tariffs. This was socialist stuff in 2015 that President Trump did, and nobody would talk about it, right? The Republicans couldn't talk about it because they believe in trickle-down economics. They don't like this stuff. And the Democrats couldn't talk about it because they couldn't say a nice word about Trump, even when he was doing a, what I consider to be a very good left-wing economic policy, right? So, yes, the media was completely obsessed with him. And I'll just give your listeners one more statistic. So they were so obsessed with him that in 2017, his name appeared in the New York Times 97,000 times, which is the equivalent of twice every article, every 250 words. That's the equivalent of that. Right. Now, you might think, okay, maybe that's just normal for a president, right? That's how many times you, President Obama in his second year in term, guess how many times his name appeared? 37,000 times. Literally an increase of 60,000 times. Why? Because they are catering to the emotions of highly educated, affluent liberals. So what makes highly educated, affluent liberals emotional? Racism and Trump. And those are the two things you're going to see over and over in the New York Times, because it's a model built on catering to emotion, on engagement. It's just like Facebook. It's become just like Facebook, essentially.
Well, and we'll have a discussion about economics another time. But pre-Trump and as well as post-Trump, it'll go back to what it was previously. It seems to me what you have is a lot of 60s hippies that went to these colleges, got into these institutions, and they found identity in part in the civil rights movement, which of course was legitimate. But they wanted to keep that identity. They want to be that we're righteous, we're saviors. And so they use black and brown people as sort of mascots, as you say, in this feedback loop to continue propagating a vision of America that is no longer reflects what America was in 1963, but they want to keep that. So it's the solidarity and marginality game. We have to find where racism doesn't exist. We're going to find it because we need supply, because our demand is insatiable. And so this is what they do. And it's the next marginalized community, black, brown, then it's going to be bisexual orientation, then it's bisexual identity, and so on and so forth.
I think that affluent white liberals use the real pain of black Americans to call America a white supremacy and then withdraw from the common good, withdraw from the idea that they owe their fellow citizens anything. Like, so instead of working together with Senator Tim Scott on his police reform bill, something that we desperately need, right? Senator Scott was pulled over 17 times in 1 year, the year he got a new car, right? He knows that we need police reform. Instead of working with him, they call for defunding the police. Right. Mm-hmm. They call for policies that flatter their egos, that black people are going to bear the burden of, that will result in more murder, in more black victimization, in more crime. There's a taboo on talking about crime because they're embarrassed by it. And they'd rather sit there and get high on their own virtue than actually help the black community. It's so infuriating.
It's a great way to sum it. Batya Unger Sargun, she's the deputy opinion editor at Newsweek. Pick up her new book, Bad News: How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. Batya, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Oh, man, it was such an honor. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us, and have a great weekend. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Hannah McDonald was a West Point cadet. She writes in The Federalist, in the spring of 21, during my first year, I was told that my decision to reject getting the optional COVID-19 vaccine would not negatively affect my time as a cadet at West Point. That quickly changed. My vaccine status was disclosed to fellow classmates, violation of HIPAA, she contends. During the summer training, my unvaccinated friends and I were segregated, ostracized, and mocked. We were laughed at as the dirty platoon of only unvaccinated and therefore masked cadets.
So rude.
Denied a pass for being unvaccinated. I was not allowed to leave campus with my friends because our radius was restricted compared to the vaccinated cadets. I could not even take an overnight pass to my sponsor's house on post, even though the same policy that restricted me from staying overnight allowed me to spend the day there. You know, cast as the other with the masking. That's good for unit cohesion, I suspect. So I was subjected to this treatment while knowing some of my fellow cadets had an adverse reaction to the vaccine, including life-changing heart problems. One of these adverse reactions resulted in heart issues. happened on the crew team. The same team kicked my best friend off for being unvaccinated, with her coach saying it, quote, went against her ethics, unquote, to coach an unvaccinated cadet.
Oh, my God.
Around the same time, guidance was pushed down that we could not even attend our religious clubs.
What?
Well, this guidance then changed shortly after. No one questioned the unethical nonsense of telling cadets they could sit shoulder to shoulder in a classroom to study calculus, but it was too much of a health threat to have us in the same classroom 6 hours later, discussing the one thing that gave us hope and comfort. The coercion grew worse when the official vaccine mandate paperwork came down on September 27th. We had a choice to either be vaccinated, separate, or apply for religious or medical exemption. We were denied legal counsel, no JAG or legal advisors available for us to talk to before signing this document. My friend's exemptions pleading natural immunity. She also has natural immunity. She was infected and recovered. Pleading natural immunity have been denied by West Point, contrary to science. I can no longer stay at an institution that claims to fight for freedom while using people as puppets to convince the public to give up their freedoms for a political show. She concludes, unfortunately, serving my country and serving in the Army don't seem to be so similar anymore. I have deep respect for West Point's legacy, for the sacrifices of our soldiers to protect and defend our country, for the cadets who work tirelessly, for the training officers and teachers who devote themselves to raising leaders, and for the amazing family I've made through some of the most wonderful people I've ever met. I tell my story not to stain the name of West Point, but to raise awareness of the persecution our military is under because of our higher leadership. I do blame the Biden administration for ignoring the pleas of thousands of soldiers. I blame Anthony Fauci for shamelessly lying time and again. I blame Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin for his lack of leadership and integrity. And I blame the leaders who have the power to make change and yet remain silent. Hannah McDonald, former West Point cadet. For more on this topic and a few others, pleased to be joined by Lieutenant General William Jerry Boykin, retired three-star general. He was Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence from 2002 to 2007 during President George W.'s administration. General Boykin, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, it's my honor to be with you.
Before we get to our friend Tom Sudeikis' project that you're a part of, Freedom Square, which, by the way, will Freedom Square and all the details will be presented at our Freedom Summit tomorrow. So we'll look forward to that and seeing Tom and everybody again. But before we get to that project, what do you say about these vaccine mandates in the military and how the military is responding per what former West Point cadet Hannah McDonald had to say?
Yeah, you know, this is unbelievable. I could never have imagined that this would be allowed to take place in something as important to our national security as our military and our military academies especially. And when you look at this, though, you need to understand that this is not about COVID. And it's really not about the vaccine. It is about compliance. And this is about fundamentally changing our society. And what people need to understand is if you want to change society, you have to change the military. And that is because the ethics and the values still held by the military are the traditional American values that our founding fathers entrusted us with. And the left today is trying so hard to change that, to move away from that, to reach a point where we have a new set of values that are associated with this wokeism, with the leftist Marxist movement in America. And if you want to do that, if you want to reach that point where those are your values, you've got to get rid of these values that still reside within our military, because the military is such a strong institution that people can always look back and say, what were we? What are we supposed to be? And, that's what we see happening right now. They're fundamentally changing our society by changing our military first.
Yeah, and so far the Air Force has discharged 40 service members, and it's now preparing to address the thousands of others. And that's just the Air Force. How do we fight back? How do they fight back?
Yeah, this is really very difficult right now. What's got to happen, what is going to happen, I can assure you, very soon, is you're going to see a couple of major lawsuits, class action lawsuits, that are clearly going to make their way all the way to West Point. But you just but put all of what you see happening in the context of what we know about, for example, the Bolshevik Revolution, about how Stalin handled things when he came to power, about the Cultural Revolution in China. What you're going to see is a lot of similarities. In fact, a frightening amount of similarities between these Marxist revolutions and what you see happening with regards to the mandate right now.
And with respect to China, you know, since we have our eye off the ball, some would argue, talking about what books General Milley is reading versus hypersonic missiles that China is stockpiling, what do you say to how this impacts our military preparedness against our enemies, like the Chinese communists, first and foremost?
Yeah, you know, you can give a soldier, you can give him the finest technology, weapons, ammunition, materiel, you can give him the finest stuff that can be produced by mankind, and you give him an edge on the battlefield, but nothing, absolutely nothing, gives him a greater edge than the cohesion within the unit that he's in. And what we are seeing happen today is people like Milley and Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense, people like that are more focused on having a woke military than they are on having a military that is ready to defeat the enemy and what the enemy has produced for itself as warfighting materiel. And these guys have lost their focus. Listen, Milley talked about white rage. Hey, I spent 36 and a half years in the military. I never saw white rage. I don't even know what white rage is. And then he talked about how he was reading Mao and Stalin and Marx and all because he wanted to understand what would bring people to breach the Capitol. That has not a darn thing to do with the military. That breach did not have anything to do with the military. Yet he, by statute, is the number one advisor to the president of all things military. He is not in the chain of command. He is an advisor. And why is he spending his time on these things that do nothing, in no way contribute to our ability to win wars?
Yeah, I mean, he characterized the Chinese testing of a hypersonic missile as a Sputnik moment in terms of missiles that could avoid our missile defenses. You would think that if he thinks it's such a serious threat, he would provide singular, maybe not quite singular, but certainly a preponderant focus on things like that as opposed to these cultural matters that you're describing. I wanted to get to this project that you signed on to with our friend Tom Sadek. It's called Freedom Square, freedomsquare.com. And you give us your characterization of and why you chose to get involved. But it seems to me this is about building community of Americans who believe in those founding principles that you were describing at the outset.
Yeah, I got a call from one of the guys that's involved in that. And that is a guy that I have trusted and loved for quite a long time, Sebastian Gorka. And Sebastian said, I just discovered something that you need to get involved in. And so I went up to Washington and sat down with these folks and looked at what they were doing. And these are patriots, first of all. These are patriots. These are people that love America, and they're not ashamed to say they love America. Secondly, they have a belief in the Almighty Creator. They are not of the same denominations, but they are all people who are unafraid to speak about their faith. And what they're doing is they are indeed putting together a community, Freedom Square. That's what they're trying to say there. A community of like-minded people, patriots, that believe in America, that believe in American values, and we're going to share information. We're going to do things online that we will make sure that we are getting the truth out about things. Right now, there's a lot of information out, but so many times you're not sure whether this is conspiracy theory or not. This this program, this platform, is going to put out information that has been verified by multiple sources, and we're going to share that with people that are really interested in what's going on in the world, but specifically in America.
All right. The project is Freedom Square, freedomsquare.com. We'll find out more about it at and its progress at our Freedom Summit tomorrow. He is Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, retired three-star general, former Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence during the President George W. Bush administration. General Boykin, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, we updated this matter of the report about possible settlement between the federal government, the Biden administration, and the ACLU on some 5,500 illegal immigrant families who were allegedly separated from their children at the border for some period of time. Would that be $450,000 per person, up to $1 million per family? That was the Wall Street Journal report.
Right.
Yesterday, Joe Biden said this.
As you were leaving for your overseas trip, there were reports that were surfacing that your administration is planning to pay illegal immigrants who are separated from their families at the border up to $450,000 each, possibly $1 million per family. Do you think that that might incentivize more people to come over illegally?
If you guys keep sending that garbage out, yeah, but it's not true.
So this is a garbage report?
Yeah.
Okay.
So $450,000 per person. Is that what you're saying?
That was separated from a family member at the border under the last administration.
That's not going to happen.
Not going to happen. That was two days ago.
But he doesn't even know what the Department of Justice's rules are. I mean, it's just another example of his ineptness.
Well, it's not about rules. He apparently didn't know that the settlement officers were going on, or he didn't know about the Wall Street Journal report detailing them, as Jim Carafano suggested to us earlier this week, probably leaked by somebody who was outraged by the prospect as that person knew the American people would be. But so, it's garbage. That's not going to happen. That's Joe Biden 2 days ago. Well, then Jen Psaki's job security deputy White House spokesman, Karine Jean-Pierre, had this to say about the possibility of such a settlement.
President Biden is calling these reports about the administration paying up to $450,000 to illegal immigrants who are separated from family members garbage. He says it's not going to happen. But the ACLU says that it is. So who is right?
Wait, are you talking about the question you asked him yesterday?
Yes.
So, if it saves taxpayer dollars and puts disastrous history of the previous administration's use of zero tolerance and family separation behind us, the president is perfectly comfortable with the Department of Justice settling with the individuals and families who are currently in litigation with the U.S. government. You know, DOJ can obviously speak more to that process. The president was – what he was reacting to was the dollar figure that was mentioned, that you mentioned to him yesterday. As press accounts to date indicate, there's been press accounts on this, DOJ made clear to the plaintiffs that the reported figures are higher than anywhere that a settlement can land.
So he is open to settlement on the topic, and now it's just a question of dollars. Okay, well, what is he or what is the Department of Justice willing to do? Because let me tell you something. I don't think the reaction is going to be much different if it's $450,000 per person or $300,000 or $250,000 per person. It's the same problem.
They come here illegally and then sue us for separating them. It makes no sense.
It's remarkable. So Joe Biden is against the settlement before it's clarified by his staff that he's actually open to the settlement, just so you're keeping score.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, you think taking a day off for vaccination awareness in CPS is something?
Yeah, next Friday.
Yeah, Vaccination Awareness Day. Right, kids have to think about being vaccinated. Right, okay. Sure, why not?
Well, the problem is I bet they're going to be disappointed at how many students don't end up getting the vaccine. I mean,
that's not the problem. The problem is the school system that has a Vaccination Awareness Day.
Well, I know that's a clear problem, but Mayor Lightfoot and CPS are just catering to the union. And, you know, they don't want to work anyway, and they're so worried because only 50% of CPS students 12 to 18 are vaccinated, and that's not enough for Jesse Sharkey because he's still scared and whining like he does every single day. So, yeah, they're having this day where they're going to explain the details this morning. Dr. Warde, the CEO of CPS, and Mayor Lightfoot are meeting at Lurie's Children's Hospital, where I'm sure they're going to say hospitalizations are up when they're not. It's a nursing shortage, by the way, not bed occupation. But they're going to explain exactly what Vaccination Fun Friday is all about next.
I'm look forward to that. And this is an opportunity, as we were talking about in Virginia, as we've been talking about for some time, you know, where can you have the greatest impact? Where you live. So, I mean, it's a little bit more difficult in Chicago because you have this centrally planned Politburo-style school system.
It's a four-day weekend next week. No school November, we call it.
How about in Glen Ellyn? Glen Ellyn is one of these towns overrun by these ghastly neo-Marxist harridans. How about the Glen Ellyn Library? You think you got enough political clout to have influence on your own library? Sort of an under-talked-about unit of government. $5 million a year in Glen Ellyn is what they get from taxpayers. They've got six board members. Let me name them. Molly Napke, Aaron Micklow, Susan Stott, Karen Volk, Molly Horster, Marianne Deaton, and apparently one dude, I can only assume because he's got a mustache, named Tim Brinker, but I'm sure if you look below the belt, he's got the undercarriage of a Ken doll. Those are your six board members at the Glen Ellyn Public Library. They celebrated National Hispanic Heritage Month. They celebrated Gay Pride. They did a Mexican Halloween-type remembrance Day of the Dead. Nothing on the calendar for Veterans Day.
Really?
Next week.
Next Thursday, huh?
This was last week, a Hindu and Buddhist festival called Diwali.
Oh, that's right.
That was Monday. Students grades 3 to 5 can come to the library to use paper, conductive tape, battery, and a light bulb to create a keepsake to celebrate Diwali.
Yeah, by the way, Congressman Raja is trying to make that a national holiday.
Super.
He's working on.
In January, the Glen Ellyn Library District paid $15,000 to a race hustling consultant named Rashida Graham Washington to instruct his employees on how to make themselves and the library less racist. Is there a problem with racism at the Glen Ellyn Library? I'd love to hear from captives in Glen Ellyn about their racist library. Please do tell.
Yeah, 312-642-5600. Lines are open.
The Glen Ellyn Library has nothing scheduled for Christmas, according to its calendar, but it does have 6 days of events planned for Kwanzaa, which, for those not familiar, Kwanzaa was invented about 50 years ago by a black market separatist named Ron Everett. Nothing for Christmas, 6 days of events for Kwanzaa. Reading recommendations for Juneteenth, How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram Kendi, a.k.a. Henry Rogers. Me and White Supremacy by Lila Saad. This year, the library invited Glen Ellyn children to participate in two separate events, a cookie baking competition and a scavenger hunt in honor of Marxist Mexican painter Frida Kahlo, who hated America and white people. Mm-hmm. In March, library staff took to issuing a public statement of solidarity with Asian Americans after that Georgia man shot 9 people working at an Atlanta massage parlor, even though, of course, we found out subsequently it had nothing to do with them being Asian. It wasn't a hate crime.
No.
Because
he was
a statement issued on the library's blog. We continue to encourage and facilitate dialogue about the harmful stereotypes that have historically and disproportionately affected the AAPI, Asian American Pacific Islander community, and all people of color, as well as how to limit the stereotypes, so on and so forth. Pete's and social justice events, talking to kids about LGBTQ+, teaching children proper terminology, including pronoun usage, and how to be an ally to the LGBT plus community. Learn how to have mutually uplifting conversations about important topics like race and gender. You get a sense of what's going on there at the Glen Allen Library with these six white people and their staff. These six white champagne socialists, Mercedes Marxists out in Glen Allen. So what about that? Can you do something about your library board? Are you paying attention to that? No. No. Again, going on everywhere. A Maryland school, I'm sure if you scratch below the surface, you'd find it here. A school in Maryland, Montgomery County, which is basically a smaller version of Cook, launched a psychoeducational lesson teaching children in schools there's a dual pandemic going on involving both COVID-19 and systemic racism. Dual pandemic. Materials recommended that teachers buy the Ibram Kendi, a.k.a. Henry Rogers book, Anti-Racist Baby, as the perfect gift for ages baby to age three.
Oh, my gosh. Great stocking stuffer, please.
So here again, we have this happening at the grade school level, at the library, and, of course, at high school, college, and beyond. So, Glen Allen Library Board, is that too big to tackle? Paula and Racine, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
So, I had been helping with our local school library, and so I joined all these, librarian forums on Facebook. Librarians are peak woke. They're the top of the pyramid. They're the most toxic of all the woke people in our society.
Yeah.
Society. They are.
How about the library board?
Books. Yeah, right. Where are they? I don't know, but I know the librarians. I mean, they're literally burning books on these forums, the books on that they disagree with, and then, celebrate it, applaud one another for literally burning books that they don't like. They're peak woke. They're just toxic people.
Thanks for the call, Paul. Maybe that'll be the next thing on the calendar. For Kwanzaa, they can have a book-burning party over at the library or downtown Glen Ellen. Just to stay away from Baroni's Pizza. It's my favorite pizza place over there.
Oh, really?
How about at Illinois State University?
What are they doing there?
You care about, you're paying taxes to send your kids to the library, to send your kids to Glen Ellen schools, pay taxes plus tuition to support state institutions allegedly of higher learning like Illinois State University. Part of the coursework for a degree in elementary education, a lot of teachers come out of Illinois State University. It's always thought of as a teacher's college. For a degree in elementary education, to go on to be a teacher, maybe in Glen Ellen. The coursework includes drag pedagogy, the playful practice of queer imagination in early childhood. This is coursework. This is like you read this and you discuss this. Give me an example of the book. This book, Drag Pedagogy, the Playful Practice of Queer Imagination in Early Childhood. This is by scholars at apparently the University of British Columbia and NYU. The abstract of the book. In recent years, a program for young children called Drag Queen Story Hour has risen to simultaneous popularity and controversy. This article, written collaboratively, that's an article, not a book, but I'm sure it'll be optioned into a book. This article, written collaboratively by an education scholar and a drag queen. Of course.
They had to be in on it.
What a collaboration, an academic and a drag queen. Who can tell the difference?
Yeah.
Education scholar and a drag queen involved organizing a drag queen story hour. It contextualizes the program within the landscape of gender and education as well as within the world of drag and argues that Drag Queen Story Hour provides a generative extension of queer pedagogy into the world of early childhood education Drawing on the work of Jose Esteban Munoz, oh, he's very good, the authors discuss five interrelated elements of Drag Queen Story Hour that offer early childhood education, or early childhood educators, excuse me, a way into a sense of queer imagination, play as praxis, meaning play as common practice, play as praxis, aesthetic, transformation, strategic, defiance, destigmatization of shame, and embodied kinship. Ultimately, the authors propose that drag pedagogy provides a performative approach to queer pedagogy that is not simply about LGBT lives, but living queerly. Student that passed this on to me assigned the article to read for the week, had a 30-minute whole class discussion about how this is a good idea to do, meaning drag queen instruction, drag queen story hour, drag queen pedagogy, LGBT pedagogy at the elementary level. This is a good idea to do, and if people don't like it, oh, well, it's not their classroom. Sounds like Terry McAuliffe is leading that course at Illinois State University. Here's how this article describes those opposed to drag queen story hour. Quoting, many of these protests against drag queen story have been instigated by a small group of far-right conservative organizations and media personalities eager to position drag queen story hour as the new face of longstanding culture wars, echoing tired homo and transphobic talking points. This backlash gestures toward the fraught nature of connecting kids to overtly queer content, particularly in politically conservative regions. Well, they won't have any problem with that in Glen Ellyn, because that's not a politically conservative region at all, is it? Used to be.
Not anymore.
But it was turned over to these Jacobin hordes, wasn't it?
How did people let that happen?
All you need to do, you have a 6-member library board in Glen Ellyn, for example.
What it's going to be on the shelves there.
You have an alumni association, Illinois State University. You have a board of trustees at Illinois State University. You have a university president. These people in positions are accessible. Bob in Downers Grove.
Hi, Dan. Yeah, thanks for airing that. That's actually from my daughter. I received that yesterday. You pretty much hit the nail on the head just by reading the content that's in there. It's twofold. First of all, this is something that shouldn't even be brought into childhood development. I mean, it's just... And the other flip side to it is to go ahead and to call us some type of right wing extremist if we don't agree with this. It makes a tuition paying parent pretty upset. Mm. And my daughter had the whereabouts to just at least send that to me. And she's the one who pointed that out and pointed out the part about if you disagree with this, you're a fringe right wing kind of fanatic group. So, this is what we're fighting. We hear about it. We didn't know if it was real, and here it is. It smacks me in the face.
Thanks for the call, Bob. Appreciate your daughter passing this along. It's great. That's encouraging. At least we got one there at ISU. Linda Glen Ellyn.
Yeah, hi Dan and Amy. Love your show. Just wanted to mention that. Yes, Glen Ellyn has gone totally woke. In the 4th of July parade, the Glenbard West Spirited Department actually had the gay flag and the gay transgender flag proudly in the 4th of July parade, but not one big American flag. It was all the big gay flags. So that's where we're at in Glen Ellyn.
Thanks for the call, Linda. Margo and Burr Ridge.
Yeah, I just wanted to expound a little bit on the Frida Kahlo thing. So this was an exhibit that was put on by College of DuPage. So this was like 6 months of extolling the virtues of Frida Kahlo, and it brought people from all around. They must have paid a fortune for the advertising. It's a very, very big deal. And not one of the people that attended, because I happened to talk to a lot of people that attended. I didn't go. Not one of them knew about her affair with Trotsky or that Trotsky was murdered in her home. Yep. None of that. But it really, they all came with, oh, she's so sweet. She's so wonderful. Blah, blah, blah. But anyway.
Maybe Margo, not to interrupt, but since we're talking about, maybe they were just unibrow enthusiasts because Frida Kahlo had a sporty unibrow. You remember?
Yes, she did. She showed pictures all over Glen Ellyn. So you can see it painted on walls outside in Glen Ellyn. It's everywhere. You can't miss it.
Thanks for the call, Margo. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the U.S. economy added 531,000 jobs in October. So that's a good bounce, according to, you know, as compared to the estimates. But, you know, with these jobs, for job seekers, maybe you need to start looking at more than just compensation, benefits, vacation time, and the like.
What else do they need?
Maybe you want to start looking at the corporate culture. I would think that working at a big company, particularly a big tech company now, I don't know that there's a number you could pay me to do that. I don't know that there's a number. And so maybe the NFIB numbers are more encouraging. NFIB reporting that 49% of all owners reported job openings they could not fill in October, but that was down a couple of points, but still half of those surveyed in their monthly. Overall, 62% reported hiring or trying to hire in October, which was down 5 points from September. But I mean, that's still a significant percentage of small business majority that are looking for employees. So maybe there's opportunity there. They also, the report is that more companies were bumping up their wages to attract more talent. Maybe in small companies, but even there, you have to be circumspect. Let me give you an example of what I mean when I say take a look at what kind of environment you're going to spend 40 or 50 or 60 or 80 hours a week before you just jump at the salary and benefits package. Would you really want to work at Microsoft? Here is the opening of a virtual security product info session within Microsoft.
Okay.
Listen to these two knuckleheads.
Hello, everyone. I'm Natalie Godilla. I'm a Caucasian woman with long blonde hair, and I go by she, her. I'm a product marketing lead here at Microsoft and co-host of the podcast Security Unlocked with this guy.
Yes, that would be me. Hello, everyone. I'm Nick Fillingham. I'm a Caucasian man with glasses and a beard. I go by he, him, and I'm a security evangelist here at Microsoft. We are so excited to be with you. Oh, my God.
Now it's not just your pronouns. You have to offer a couple of physical attributes, too. Hi, I'm Dan Proft. I'm a radio talk show host. I'm a Caucasian male with a 5 o'clock shadow and a bad attitude. Let's get started.
Hi, I'm Amy Jacobson. I'm a white female, tall, and I have blonde hair. Head tilt.
I mean, seriously.
Oh, my God. That's nauseating.
It's like an external lobotomy to work in one of these environments. All right, for more on the jobs numbers and maybe some commentary on corporate culture as well, please be joined again by our friend Carol Roth. She's a former investment banker, entrepreneur, author of the book, The War on Small Business, How the Government Used the Pandemic to crush the Backbone of America. And she also co-hosts our program from time to time. Carol, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, guys. I actually have some insight into the Microsoft situation, and it's not as dire as you think it is. Can I start off sharing that?
Well, first, you have to identify yourself properly first before
she,
you
her? Sharing. What are we today, Carol?
I don't give in to peer pressure, guys. Okay. I actually work with Microsoft in the past. They're a great organization. So what they were trying to do there, and, you know, sometimes intentions and executions don't show up in the same way, but they were trying to add accessibility for the visually impaired. So they were trying to give some descriptors that if you couldn't see the program, that you could sort of visualize who you were talking to. And so that's a good thing. I think we want to be accessible. I don't think that they did a great job in terms of executing.
Who cares what they look like? Why do I don't care if you're Caucasian or male, or I mean, I could probably pick up male or female by voice, but I don't care if you have long hair, short hair, a beard, a faux hawk. Who cares?
Well, because people who, you know, have the inability to visualize want to feel like they can kind of see the person and kind of come up with their own you know, view of you know who the people are. Well, you know, again, I think that's a nice thing. I think that's a worthwhile thing. I just feel like the execution was perhaps off, and they could have explained a little bit better what they were doing so that people didn't have the reaction that you and so many other people did, which without the explanation makes a lot of sense to have that reaction.
All right. Well, you can work with Microsoft. I don't want to. And that's okay. I'm basically going to end up back in on a golf course caddying before it's all said and done, the way things are going in this country, which is fine. All right. So give us your review. We'll just start with the jobs number, the 531,000. And that's in spite of these supply chain woes, though, that was reflected in worker productivity at a 40-year low, which really is a reflection on not enough product.
Yeah, I mean, it's what the market would say is sort of a Goldilocks report, you know, just right, not too hot and not too cold. And I think the encouraging thing was that we had more private sector jobs. So of that 531, there was actually 600,000+ in the private sector, and we lost 70,000 government jobs, which is always music to my ears. So it's sort of what I expected, right? You had people who were out of the labor force for a long time. They were out all summer. They weren't going to, you know, head right back in September, especially with all the uncertainty around would schools still be open and trying to find the right job. So this was sort of what I was expecting. You know, the big issue that we have is the labor force participation, and only about 100,000 people came back into the labor force. And so we just don't have enough people seeking jobs, and we're still more than 4 million jobs down from our peak in February 2020. So, you know, while this was encouraging, and, you know, we likely will get a few more reports, you know, within this realm, you know, can we get back to where we were before? And if we do at this clip, you know, it still takes us, you know, well into the middle plus of next year. You know, still not the greatest, but good enough for the market to be happy.
Well, I mean, this, you know, supply chain crisis is a problem. I have a email here from a parent from Unified District 46 in Elgin. They sent out an email letting people know, we don't anticipate the nationwide supply crisis to end anytime soon. And in fact, most indicators are alerting us that it will continue to worsen through the winter months because they're going to have to change the ingredients and what food they can supply to kids during school hours. And that's, you know, for a lot of parents, that's pretty scary stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt there will be a continued supply chain problem well into next year. And as we head into the winter months, that means things like your refrigerator or your HVAC system. You know, if it goes on the fritz, you may not be able to get parts. You may not be able to get a replacement. So it is a good time to anticipate if there's anything you really need. You don't need to hoard it, but, you know, slowly go pick it up, or have, you know, your HVAC and your refrigerator and your big appliances, you know, just have them checked out and see if there's anything that looks like it might be on the fritz, because, you know, with this clip of people just kind of dripping back into the labor force, it is still going to be a big drag on the supply chain for months and months to come, and that's, you know, both here as well as abroad.
And, of course, the left says all we need to do is another $4 trillion in funny money spend, launch a few more entitlement programs. And of course, the way they're going to do it is by making the rich pay their fair share, which is why I'm baffled by this inclusion in the latest iteration of the tax and spend-a-thon bill. House Democrats proposing to raise the annual SALT deduction cap, the state and local tax deduction cap, to $72,500 through 2031 after Republicans had limited it in 2017 to $10,000. So this is all about providing tax relief to wealthy people in high-tax blue states. But I thought we want the wealthy to pay their fair share.
Well, it depends which wealthy, right?
Oh. Certainly
all of us, you know, here in Illinois, as well as the other blue states, know that we got the short end of the stick when they changed that provision the last time around. And the reality of the situation, as I've tried to explain to many people, is as a state, you know, our state and many of the other high-tech blue states do subsidize other states overall. You know, we pay more into the federal government than we get back from them as a state. So, you know, I'm a big fan of doing that. But, yeah, I mean, it's obviously from a hypocrisy level. They always sell things, right, as we're going after the big guys. But we know that it's really meant to come after the middle class. And particularly, if you're a Democrat, you're going to find a way around it. And, you know, if you look at some of the proposals like sneaking into and peeking into people's bank accounts and getting the reports of their aggregate inflows and outflows, the hiring of more IRS agents, you know, all of these proposals that, you know, certainly is not, you're not hiring 87,000 additional IRS agents to go after, you know, 700 billionaires. I mean, you're just not. So everything that they say, you know, is a lie. And I think that the good news is that more people are starting to realize that. We saw that in the election a couple nights ago and in certain places. So hopefully people are waking up to the gaslighting.
And with respect to that number, I said, and I think I said $4 trillion. If I didn't, that's what I meant, because I know the talk now is the negotiated framework between Manchin and Biden. And if you couldn't tell from my tone of voice, I was using air quotes. Of 1.75 trillion, but the Penn Wharton budget model, as the Wall Street Journal reported, rolled out yesterday, says that's not what it is. The price tag is more like 3.98, or in other words, $4 trillion. That's the real price tag. There's both more spending, 1.75 trillion, than is presented, and much less in taxes by a figure of about $2 trillion, according to that model.
Yeah, well, you know, I went to Wharton, so, you know, I'm going to throw my support behind that model. But the reality is that the way we saw the numbers presented even early on, obviously, were, again, smoke and mirrors. They were doing things like starting programs later, or, you know, only showing the programs for a handful of years and they have to be renewed in order to make that headline number look like it was smaller than it actually was. So as we know, you know, anytime they throw out a number of spending, we know it's going to be higher. And in terms of tax collections, they never take into account the implications of what happens when you slap a tax, which is, you know, something that you do when you want less of something. So if you want less revenue, you slap a tax on revenue, and you're going to get less of it. And they never, you know, factor in how that flows through the economy into their models. So definitely some of these independent models are going to be more accurate.
You're sort of getting to this, you mentioning it as we were talking through some of these topics, but just sort of from a blue sky perspective, your recent column that we're living through this great transfer of wealth from the middle class to the elites, perhaps the largest in history. Tell us what's happening. Give us sort of a sense of the dynamic.
Yeah, I mean, we absolutely, you know, from 2020 on, and you can argue it started earlier than that, but that was sort of the big fire. We have lived through the biggest transfer of wealth in all of history, not just in terms of the mandates that shut down small businesses and transferred those revenues to big companies where, you know, customers could actually spend their money, but in terms of the Federal Reserve and the trillions of dollars that it is, quote unquote, I'm going to use air quotes now, Dan. quote unquote, printed from nowhere, and, you know, thrown into the market, which basically, if you are a saver, if you're somebody who's trying to retire, you're not earning anything on your money. But at the same time, there is all this available capital for big businesses to access and to compete with smaller businesses. We saw seven tech companies last year gain $3.4 trillion in value. And even though the Federal Reserve said it's now going to, quote unquote, taper, yes, slow down its level of purchases, it's still going to continue purchasing. So we have $8.6 trillion today, approximately, on the Fed's balance sheet. If the taper goes, you know, via the way that they're saying it will go, $15 billion a month slower each consecutive month, still going to take about 8 months to run off, so about another $420 billion. So that's going to put them over $9 trillion there was several on the balance sheet when we started this, but all that additional money is asset inflation that benefits the wealthy, while us as average Americans are dealing with higher prices and not being able to earn a return on our capital.
So are you more sanguine than some of the Wall Street honchos like the CIO at Morgan Stanley about market performance in the coming quarters? I mean, they're calling for 25% at least market correction. And how much is your view informed by whether or not another few trillion dollars of funny money is passed?
Yeah, I mean, so I haven't pulled any money out of the market, so that tells you that I'm not today worried about a 25% correction. Not to say that a correction can't be coming at some point in time, but I do think the Fed is behind the eight ball because they are basically supporting the government's bad spending policies. And right now, I think it's somewhere around 15% of our budget, 12 to 15% of every dollar that the government gets goes to service our debts. And so if interest rates really start to rise, I mean, at some point that could double up to, if it gets normalized, it could double up to like 30%, which is going to obviously crowd out a lot of other spending and create a lot of other problems. So they need for the government to be able to, quote unquote, function to keep interest rates, as low as possible for as long as possible. And then obviously, given the time frame that they're going to try and hold that back, I do think that, the companies in the market are not the economy. We're seeing that great consolidation. We're seeing the big companies benefit at the expense of the little companies. So I do think the small and to some extent the mid-sized companies are going to have a much more difficult time navigating that than some of the big companies. But we will get a correction at some point. We'll probably, I think, go sideways here for some period of time. But it's really hard to make a full-on prediction because so much of this is predicated on what happens with these spending bills and how they decide to pay for them, and that will change the game entirely. So would love to revisit that prediction with you once we have more clarity on that.
Very good. That's fair. Carol Roth, former investment banker, entrepreneur, author of The War on Small Business, How the Government Used the Pandemic to Crush the Backbone of America. Carol, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Have a great weekend, guys.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Open mic! Open mic Friday! Coming now! Open mic Friday!
Yes, it's that time of the week. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, taking your calls with concerns, critiques, compliments, commentary, general crack pottery. We'll take it all. Amy, why don't you start? I know you're raring to go.
Yeah, well, we have 4-day weekend, not this weekend, next weekend coming up because Veterans Day, which is good. But then the crazy vaccination awareness day. So parents can take their kids to be vaccinated. More than 60% of CPS students, their parents work during the day. So it's counterintuitive. What they think is going to be beneficial is not beneficial to parents because then we would have to take a day off of work to go get our kids vaccinated, which we're not going to do. So the madness continues. But also I wanted to tell you, what are you doing tomorrow morning, Dan, before you go to Freedom Summit?
I'm having breakfast.
Okay. That's a good answer. Maybe getting in a round of golf. It's going to be beautiful this weekend. But Saturday morning, Mayor Lightfoot is joining faith leaders across, from all denominations across Chicago's 77 neighborhoods to pause for a shared moment of prayer for COVID-safe holidays. Yes, it's going to be a COVID holiday season once again. So they're going to pray to reflect on, as we enter the holiday seasons, what we need to do to stay safe.
All right. All the parishioners of Our Lady of Perpetual COVID shall gather. That's great.
Isn't that great? So I just wanted to let you know about that little ditty at 9 o'clock in the morning.
One of the big reactions, the efforts by the left to contextualize Tuesday's election results was that critical race theory, which became such a topic and a point of contention and a motivator for Democrats to cross over and vote for Glenn Youngkin in Virginia. Critical race theory in the schools. Well, I'll cede my time on critical race theory and whether or not that's real or not. to a teacher named Daniel Buck, who was compelled to go to Twitter to post what he knows to be true as a practitioner. And clearly, as you'll hear, somebody who's steeped in critical theory because he knows all the leading intellectual lights of this intellectual fraud.
Look, Twitter, I'm about to drive home, but I keep seeing this take. Critical race theory is not in schools. It's all a Republican lie. It's gaslighting. Blah, 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 blah. Okay, critical race theory, critical pedagogy, all of it, not just critical race theory, but critical pedagogy is in schools. It's to suggest otherwise is patently false. Gloria Ladson-Billings in the 1990s wrote a paper, "What is critical race theory doing in a nice field like education?" Okay, in the 90s. Kimberly Crenshaw wrote another scholarly article about celebrating 20 years of critical race theory. And in it, she says critical race theory has worked its way into all sorts of different fields, including philosophy, economics, and education. Paulo Freire, not a critical race theorist, but he is a critical pedagogue, is one of the most assigned texts in schools of education. Okay. Are students reading Richard Delgado, a critical race theorist, in high school classrooms? No. But the language, the theory, the philosophy, the application, the arguments, the policies of critical theory in general, not just critical race theory, are worked into every part of schooling right now. Okay. It starts in the academy and then it leaks on to everything else. There are interesting discussions to be had about whether or not a high school student could learn about critical theory like they learn about communism or capitalism, okay? These are debates that we can have. But we got to start from a place of truth, which is that critical theory is in K-12 education, okay? I'm a teacher. Make sure to follow this. Not a lot of people are saying this. Not a lot of teachers are, but I know other people are thinking it. So make sure to retweet, like, and follow. Have a great day. I'm going to go play with my dog now that the workday's done.
There you go. So good for Daniel Buck. And by the way, it's not about this not being taught. It's not afraid to address it. It's about it being indoctrinated. It is the theory, not a theory. You shall comply. You shall think this way. That is the fundamental problem for those who want to say, oh, well, you know, were you afraid to read the Marx Engels Reader? No, I've read it. That's not the issue. The issue is not being part of something kids are exposed to. It's being force-fed down their throats and into their gray matter. That's the issue. John in Arlington Heights, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, John and Amy.
Hello, go ahead.
Hey, Dan, if I meet you on the floor of the street at 2 in the morning, we'll have a drink and agree on most things. But I'll tell you what's kind of bothering me is talk show hosts that take the vaccine and yet they encourage other people to protest and not get through their work. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. But to me, it's kind of like I'm taking this lifeboat. There'll be another one along for you in a few minutes. Don't worry.
Well,
maybe I'm wrong.
Well, John, I don't think that's the position. I think the position is if you want to get vaccinated, get vaccinated, but it shouldn't be mandated. I think that's the I'm not speaking for every conservative talk show host. That's certainly my position, and I'm not vaccinated, by the way.
And but, I am vaccinated, but it's about choice.
Right. So that, I think it's more about the mandates, the imposition that we're going to create an apartheid class. I think it's about that, not somebody that chooses to get vaccinated because, again, I've said it before, I've said it a million times, I'll say it a million and one. For some people, particularly older, comorbidities, sure, it makes sense. It's all about your individual risk profile in consultation with your doctor making that choice, but that choice being left to you as the individual and not being imposed by the state. And I'll look forward to that drink at 2 a.m.
Yeah, that sounds good. You heard what's going on in San Francisco. So kids have to show proof of vaccination for indoor events. So if you're vaccinated and your child who's 5 isn't, you can't get into certain restaurants, plays, any indoor games. It's ridiculous. There's not even parental choice anymore if you want your kid to have a normal life.
Holly in St. Louis.
Hey, good morning and happy Diwali.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
What are you wearing? What did you get? What kind of card did you get, Dan, for Diwali Day?
Huh? Well, you know, Diwali is celebrating good over evil, light over darkness. So again, it's particularly relevant.
Yeah, so I don't want to interrupt, but again, the Glen Ellyn Public Library story we talked about last hour, which is what you're referencing, it's not about celebrating Diwali, exposing kids to Diwali. It's not about that. It's about doing that for the purpose of eliminating Christmas, for eliminating Veterans Day. It's never about embracing and learning about other cultures, other religious traditions. It's about doing so to the exclusion of Christianity, to the exclusion of America's founding principles. That's the issue.
Well, right, and I knew that. That was just an aside. But I'm calling today for two reasons. One, I want to speak on behalf of everyone in the listening audience that from here on, all singing Open Line Friday is banned. No one can call in and sing, and you and Amy definitely cannot sing.
Okay.
And Amy, that goes for when Bruce Wolf sits in over Christmas. I'm speaking on behalf of every listener in this audience. All right. The reason I called is because I was raised by a blue-collar man who was a mechanic in Albuquerque, and there are four of us in the family, kids. He drilled this into our heads from the time we were three. The government does not make money. The government, if the government's going to give you something, it's going to have to take it away from somebody else first. And I think this is such a simple, perfect lesson. I made sure all of my kids understood this because I'm hearing people, even pundits on TV, talk about the government's money, that what the government's going to be doing with their money. The government does not make money. Very simple concept. Every kid, every person in America needs to know this. The government does not make money. It only takes money.
Thanks for the call, Holly. Good axiom. Paul in Orland Park.
Hi, I'd like to know, I really want to understand why nobody steps in and puts a stop to this time change. This has been going on forever. I think it's ridiculous. I think most people think it's ridiculous. And when will this ever end? Thank you.
All right, Paul. Rich
Marco Rubio was promoting that yesterday.
Oh, he was. There you go. Yeah. Marco Rubio.
Marco Rubio's your hero for
little
the time
Marco's
change.
On it. Yeah. All right, Rich. Rich.
Yeah, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I'm a senior white male who thinks a lot younger than he is, but physically is not. So what I have to say is, what I came away from these elections this week is that people are finally waking up. They're tired of being called racist. They're tired of having to apologize for being white. They're tired of the Democratic politicians telling them that they have no say-so in their education. And overall, the people in this country don't want to defund the police. They want safe neighborhoods. And as far as Barack and Biden and Tickle Me Kamala going to Virginia to campaign for this self-centered moron, I think that was ridiculous. And the final thing is, I'm tired of Biden saying how he's going to build back better, which is a lie, when the people can see that the Democrats are just trying to destroy the country. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, and let's go, Brandon.
All right. Thanks, Rich. Dawn in Naperville.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to make a comment in regards to your discussion about why more parents are homeschooling. I do feel that it was partly two things. Number one, they were saying that there was curriculum that was being taught that was totally not appropriate in a free, appropriate education. But number two, and it's more important, I think parents knew more than ever, and they saw more than ever, the skill deficit that their child had in reading and writing and mathematics. And they realized that by educating their child at home, they were actually progress monitoring, and they were making more progress than they were at school. And, I mean, I can tell you firsthand, I just had an IEP meeting last week. I gave statistical data at the IEP meeting that 60% of our prison population is functionally illiterate, 85% of our juveniles are functionally illiterate, 14% of my new district that I'm in, the kids with IEPs are functionally illiterate, only 14% were proficient in reading. So, oddly enough, when I got the meeting notes back from the IEP meeting, those statistical data that I gave was missing out of the meeting notes. So here's what I will tell that teacher that you just hit on, they don't want to have a debate. They don't want to have a debate. You have to understand the people that you work for, they only want one thing. It's a dictatorship. So if your child has an IEP and they're not progressing, you call for an IEP meeting, you have a mediation with the state, you have a due process, but you fight. And if they don't want to give it what your child needs, pull them out, do a lateral placement, put them in a placement where they will learn, then go back to the district and ask for reimbursement. But you have to fight back against these people. And you know what? I've even let my board know. I'm waiting to hear back from my board, who won't respond to a letter that I wrote, that my child is not proficient in reading and writing, and which they say in their own curriculum standard, they're supposed to be proficient by grade one. So I would like to know in Naperville 204, how many of your children are proficient by the time they're in grade one or ending grade one? So
thanks for the call, Dawn. Appreciate that. Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Hello?
Hey, Bob.
Yeah. Good morning. I have a problem, I guess, with the phone hearing you. Good topics and discussion this week. So much I could have weighed in, but let me rewind to your discussion yesterday on parents and CRT. Because of virtual learning, parents are now finding out what their children are being taught. And I guess some people don't like, or some of the parents don't like it. Into the future, I wonder how this is going to impact the curriculum of the schools, since the parents are finding out what's going on.
Yeah.
And parents are revolting at the school board meetings because of this. And you probably know it, but the left-wing politicians and the media don't like it.
Thanks for the call, Bob. Appreciate it. You know, there's no question the landscape for K through 12, I think, is going to change. That's a good thing. Andrea in Wheaton.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Ray Bradbury has a wonderful novel called Something Wicked This Way Comes, in which evil's defeated by laughter. And the Babylon Bee just put out a guide to wokeness that is just, I'm just doubled over in laughter, and it's a wonderful antidote to having to deal in this culture.
Yeah, we had the author on yesterday.
Babylon
Bee's Guide to Wokeness. Yeah, we talked to one of their staff yesterday. Thanks for the call, Andrea. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.